Welcome to the Boiler Room, an Arena podcast. We're your hosts, Julia.
And I'm Santiago. And Julia, what are we talking about today?
Today, we're talking about relational organizing, which I'm so excited for.
Yes. This is actually a topic that I've been excited for us to cover. I feel like every single Arena training that we do, this is one where like I try to get into the seat of the trainee and just learn as much as I can about how different this is from organizing or how similar it is.
Yeah, it seems like every cycle, there's a shiny new object that everyone is talking about in politics. And just a few cycles ago, it was texting. And then more recently, it is relational organizing.
Yeah, what's that new silver bullet? Like, what's that thing that's going to solve everything in campaigns, everything that ails us? I don't know. I always kind of approach these things with like just a little bit of caution and a little bit of skepticism. But I also remember like when I was coming up on campaigns as an organizer, running into veterans, people of campaign, you know, who have many campaigns under their belts, like just coming in and being super skeptical of any new approaches. And I know that I never wanted to be that. And so also trying to put my learning hat on, check myself and kind of learn from the best on this.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm so excited for the two interviews that we have for this episode. But I'm totally with you, Santiago. I feel like I remember when relational organizing was introduced as a term and everyone sort of looked at each other and was just like, isn't this just organizing? Isn't that what it's called? And you know me, I come from a labor background. I was an organizer with labor unions, both SEIU and the UAW, and really like hold my organizing roots in those places. And so to me, a lot of this material is actually like harkens back to labor organizing. Because one of the first things that you do when you want to organize a workplace is you do this thing called power mapping. So let's say you, Santiago, you're a very strong supporter of the union. You know, you're one of those people who came out first and said, yeah, I want a union. We need a union. And so me as an organizer, I'm going to go to you, Santiago, and I'm going to ask you, okay, who else do you know who would be supportive of this, right? Who else would you want to talk to about this? And so we would start to map out from there who you could talk to, but we would also map out, okay, who definitely isn't a supporter? Like, who aren't we going to talk to? Who is maybe too close to management? Who is doing some things that, you know, we're going to save them for last? We want to find our supporters first. We want to talk to those people who you're close with, who you know. And to me, relational organizing on campaigns very much harkens back to that because it's about friends talking to friends. It's about family members talking to family members. It's about mapping out from your circle those networks of people who you are attached to and figuring out who would be supportive of this candidate or this cause, right? So to me, a lot of relational organizing harkens back to that.
Yeah. And it just feels like such a natural thing that we should be trying to do that we're probably doing in some way, shape or form anyway, you know, already with our family members. I'm already getting lots of questions about vote by mail and like, what do you do? You know? And so like, it seems only natural that we would try to incorporate that. And I think one of the things like, you know, as you're talking about like starting to do that power mapping, who has relationships where, like, you know, there's a lot of tracking that comes related to that. You know, you're starting to tally who's with us, who's not, you know, so there's a lot of data there. And I think some of my skepticism comes from like, what are the ways that we can kind of track this information? How do we incorporate it into the other tactics that we might be using on a campaign? Also the tracking of it is important to me because at the end of the day, we're trying to get, you know, votes in a particular geography in a district. And so hopefully some of the conversations that you'll be having that we're going to be sharing will help illuminate some of how some of the practitioners of relational organizing really think of some of these challenges related to targeting and reporting on some of this data, because it can be incredibly useful to campaigns.
Absolutely. And I'm so excited for these conversations. Totally agree with you. We talk about this. We talk about the challenges that come with tracking this information. And also the power, right? I think, you know, one of the reasons why this became such a popular tactic and we started talking about relational organizing so much was because there was a lot of research out there that showed how effective it could be. Sure, it's difficult to scale because I only know, you know, of my 1,000 Facebook friends, I'm probably only actually like close friends with like 10 of those people, right? So, you know, doing this sort of relational outreach, it can be pretty limited, but at the same time, there's huge potential for it. Particularly, I think, along the lines of how can we activate folks who aren't like you and me, Santiago, who are definitely volunteering, are definitely engaged, like definitely know who we're going to vote for. How do we use this as a tactic to maybe engage those folks who are going to think about their ballots a week before the election, are going to think about these things, you know, it's not top of mind all the time. So how can we use this as a way to kind of increase voter participation?
Yeah, I think that's what's also interesting is like, it certainly has the potential for increasing participation. You know, I think I see it mostly on like social media, celebrities talking about like, and make sure 10 of your friends are like gonna turn out and vote. One thing I think we talk about less is what is the potential for how we build our campaigns, build our capacity, build up our lists of supporters. How do we use this as a persuasion tactic? And so I feel like there's so much like kind of either so much that we don't talk about or things that maybe we don't know campaigns are experimenting with in terms of how they're using this tactic in other ways that help campaigns win.
And I think that's a great jumping off point to introduce our first interview of today. We talked with Greta Carnes. So Greta was most recently the national organizing director for Mayor Pete Buttigieg's presidential campaign. I'm going to say that because of her, I know how to pronounce that name. And because of that team, I can actually say that on a podcast without completely stumbling. But she built an organizing program that trained and empowered Pete supporters to leverage their personal relationships to organize. And over the last 10 years, Greta has worked in digital organizing and technology on electoral campaigns at every level, including the Hillary campaign, Obama's presidential campaign, as well as some House, Senate, in gubernatorial races across the country. So she brings a lot of knowledge to this conversation. She helped pilot and pioneer a very innovative organizing program for Mayor Pete during the primary. And I'm super excited for you to hear this conversation.
She's wonderful. I'm excited too.
So I am so thrilled to talk today with Greta Carnes, who is here to talk to us about relational organizing on campaigns. Greta, we're so, so delighted to have you on the Arena Boiler Room podcast.
Oh, I'm so excited that it's called Boiler Room.
I know. It's like we wanted to be able to pull back the curtain, and also because the fact that, you know, we kind of miss boiler rooms and the fact that they're going to look a lot different this year than they have in any other year.
Oh, yeah. Or also might be the most similar thing to previous campaign life, locked in a room alone.
For sure. Well, Greta, you know, we're here to talk about relational organizing, but just wanted to open it up a little bit and just ask you to tell us a bit about who you are and your background in organizing and also in digital.
Yeah, the dual background. So I got started in campaigns when I was 15. Barack Obama was running, and I was one of those, you know, not even voters, who was incredibly excited that he was running for office and that it was something that I could do that wasn't high school. So I started volunteering and pretty much fell in love with organizing right away. Ended up skipping a lot of class and got kicked off my soccer team because I was knocking doors. And so then I think I really just fell in love with the idea of getting to mobilize communities and, you know, empower people, especially at like a really hyper-local level. And so I think as I've progressed on my career, I think I keep coming back to that same really excited passion about, you know, having my second grade best friend's mom be somebody that I was knocking doors next to. And so then I, you know, was an organizer for Obama in Iowa in 2012. And after that, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. And I didn't know what the path forward for organizing looked like. And I accidentally fell into digital for a while. And so when I was in digital, I really started learning about how to mobilize people online, you know, through email, but also through social media, and eventually through texting. And the more that I learned about, you know, the online world, the more I think I started thinking, why don't we give organizers these tools and tactics? And it was right around the time that digital organizing started becoming a thing. And I think, you know, there's a couple different ways to think about digital organizing. And I think the way that I got really excited about it is how do we integrate more digital tactics and tools into our organizing work? instead of keeping those things separate? How do we bring them much more together? So I excitingly had the chance to do that in the last year as Pete's National Organizing Director. It was very weird to go from digital back into organizing and at such a level, but I think it was really great because I got to experiment with what happens when we don't have a digital organizing team or department, and what happens when our digital department, you know, owns the things that organizing wouldn't touch, but we get to own tools and we get to own training and we get to equip our organizers with tools like peer-to-peer texting, but we also get to equip our organizers with all of the training on how to, you know, organize online as well as offline. And it was really exciting. And so I think it's been fun because I think, you know, the more we break down campaign silos, the better our campaigns are. And I think it's been a lot of fun as these, you know, this world I think has evolved so quickly, especially just digital. I mean, you know, like digital has changed so much in the last 10 years that it's been a very cool thing to get to keep iterating on.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for explaining that. And I feel like that combination between organizing and digital, like the space between the two has conflated and disappeared even more just in the past few months.
Yes.
And I also feel like it's provided this really fertile place for what we're here to talk about, relational organizing, to grow, because you sort of like, you need the tools and you need the organizing, and those two things kind of grow together. And I know on Pete's campaign, you all did a lot of work with relational. But I just want to start with sort of a general question before we get into the everything you did with the Pete campaign. I just want to hear from you, like, what in your mind is relational organizing? We talk about it all the time.
Yes.
What is it? It's when did you first hear about it?
It means a million things to a million different people. In my mind, relational organizing is the idea that people are more likely to be persuaded by somebody in their life than they trust, especially about something political, than a stranger. So it is the idea that it is more effective to have, if you can, friends and family talk to a voter than it is to have a stranger talk to that voter. That's it.
Mic drop. That's it.
Simple definition.
Amazing. I love that. And I want to double click on your use of persuasion. But first, just want to ask sort of about the relational programs that you ran for Pete for America, particularly in the Iowa caucuses. I know you did some innovative things and would love to just hear about those.
Yeah. So I think I really, really like that you started it with a definition, because I think there have been so many conversations, especially in the last year, around relational. And I think, you know, one thing that makes me really excited is that a ton of campaigns did some iteration of it in the primary. But I think what's not great is that every campaign has a slightly different definition, and we are sort of missing each other as we're trying to have conversations about it, which I'm hoping we can all look forward to after 2020 is over. We can all sit down and have a conversation about what we think this, you know, this idea and this concept is, and how we can make it better and fine tune it. But so essentially with Pete, I think it started in a couple different ways. One, it's really important to say, we had a candidate that nobody knew. Nobody knew his last name. We had no money. We had no infrastructure. There were more than 20 candidates in the race. It was a longer than long shot, and we had to figure out how to cut through the noise, even in small ways, every single day. So that was like one half of it. I think the other half of it was that in 2018, I had been involved in, I hate to keep saying this, but I had been involved in texting, and I took 2018 off to really dig into tech tools, especially organizing tools. And it was right around the time that all these texting tools were available. And so while I was digging into tools, I discovered all these new relational organizing tools that had come on the market in 2017, and became more excited about the idea of the concept of relational organizing, but also looking through the lens of tools and thinking how tools could either help or hinder. And so for me, that's why I really don't define relational organizing as being related to a tool or a specific app or tech. To me, relational organizing is exactly like organizing. It is figuring out how to talk to people and figuring out how to build a program around people talking to their friends and family. It's not, you know, using a certain tool. Tools can help, but it can't be conflated with a tool. So with Pete's campaign, we thought, you know, if we're going to run this organizing program for somebody who could be viable in a month or who could not be, how can we really throw out the playbook and try something different with the hopes that we can cut through the noise? So what we did was, instead of, you know, I think right now we have gotten really practiced at running one kind of organizing program, where we build an organizing program that recruits enough volunteers to knock enough doors and make enough phone calls. And I think that we keep adding onto that, but that is the foundation of most organizing programs. It is about knocking doors and making phone calls. And sometimes we throw texts in there and we say, we also want to send this many texts. Sometimes we throw digital in there. You know, you might have nebulous digital organizing that you also should be doing on the side, but mostly it's that. And so we said, what if we don't knock doors or make phone calls? What if we just threw out those metrics? And so that's why I think, you know, we've gotten some feedback since that, you know, why do we call our program relational organizing when it's just organizing? That is completely accurate. Our program is just organizing, but what we did instead is we threw out the idea of direct voter contact for a long time and for the most of the summer and into the fall, and you really get to do this for a caucus or a primary, so it's important to note that. But for the summer and the fall, we essentially said, how do we recruit volunteers and explicitly just ask them to talk to their friends and family for a while? So part of the great part about that was that we got to rethink metrics. So instead of measuring, you know, phone calls, doors, we didn't measure commit cards. Instead, we measured, in the Iowa caucus, we had all of our organizers recruiting what we called relational volunteers. We're just volunteers who agreed to talk to their friends and family. And then we measured how many conversations they were having. VAN is not super equipped to measure these. So it was, you know, we got to work with our incredible data team, specifically two women on the data team who helped us write new reports and really helped like our thinking about how do we measure something that's, you know, measuring a conversation is a difficult thing to measure. But it ended up being great because instead of measuring attempts, you know, instead of measuring how many phone calls we made, but not necessarily knowing how many people answered, we were able to measure what we were actually doing in a way that I think was a lot more informative, especially when there were this many candidates in the race. The other thing that we, you know, that was specific to this primary is we knew we didn't want to be somebody's 10th door knock on a Saturday. If every campaign was knocking the same number of doors in Iowa, you know, we didn't want to, and knocking the doors of the same voters, we didn't want to be yet another cold conversation when we instead could be infiltrating communities in a lot more successful ways by having Pete's name come from your mom or your best friend instead of from a stranger at your doorstep. The other benefit for it that I really loved watching was two things. One, I think it really empowered people who aren't necessarily familiar with campaigns or who aren't, you know, super comfortable knocking doors or making phone calls. Everybody got to be a volunteer. My parents will never knock a door in their lives, despite the fact that they have a hyper-political daughter who begs them every single cycle. And instead, you know, my dad would wear his Boot Edge Edge shirt to Costco and talk to people about Pete. And my mom would pass around Pete's book to her swim group. And that was ways that they felt more comfortable getting involved in the election. But I think the other thing that was really inspiring to watch is that because people's friends and family don't necessarily fall into a universe that we would cut for a campaign or for an organizing program, we talked to everybody. And so we ended up talking to people in, you know, in rural Iowa who had not had a Democrat talk to them because campaigns, it doesn't make sense to send our resources to those areas if we want to win by whatever vote. But it does, you know, if people have a best friend who lives there and they reach out to them, we ended up recruiting precinct captains who are Republicans. We ended up recruiting a ton of people into the campaign who had never caucused before, some people who hadn't voted before, just because we had our folks talk to everybody. And we were able to have conversations with people that I think were really surprising. And so what I think is important about the program is that, and what I think is really critical is that relational is a tactic. It is not an entire program, right? At some point, you're going to hit the number of people that your volunteers know, and that's going to be, you know, a stopping point. And so there is a part of the program where you're also going to have to talk to strangers. But what I think is really important and what we did really well, I think, is that we started by recruiting people to talk to their own networks, and we used that as a ladder to get people to also talk to strangers. So it was a way to sort of both train people on like how to organize. I think it was really helpful for our volunteers to see, oh great, I could text my five friends right now and have conversations with all five of them, or I could make five phone calls and have nobody pick them up, you know? And so it was really helpful to walk our volunteers through the mechanics of organizing and making a decision about who do I call versus who do I text versus who in my neighborhood, you know, can I get involved? And I think it pushed a lot of power down, which I think was really important. We, you know, pulled the strategy back and we said, there's no list that we could cut for you to make phone calls that's more important than the list of people that you already know in your life. And I think that we, you know, by the end of the campaign, we introduced door knocking in November and December and started doing a ton of cold outreach as well. But I think at that point, it was great because we had built the momentum and we had built a volunteer base that understood how to have conversations, understood how to have effective conversations because they had had them with their friends and family, their own networks. Mm-hmm. And we had people who I think felt enough ownership over the campaign at that point that they felt comfortable organizing their whole community, not just their own social circle. That was a long answer.
No, got it. That's amazing. And absolutely love it and love hearing about the program and also sort of having the sort of 2020 hindsight on it. Now at this point, I feel like, you know, we're constantly debriefing, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, there are two things that you mentioned that I would love to double click on because they seem so core to a relational program. One is the training. You mentioned that, would love to just hear, training nerd here. I'll just say that up front, but like, how did you train these volunteers to have those conversations? And especially, you know, if it did or didn't have a script. And then the second part is data. What you mentioned in one of the challenges of relational programs, which is how to track everything. But maybe you can start with training and just how did you go about empowering your volunteers to have these conversations?
It's a great question because I often refer to our program as being mostly a training program. And I think that the way that we thought about our organizers ended up being our organizers were almost like local training directors or like local coaches. So, you know, I don't think our organizers did a lot of the outreach until the very, very end, but instead our organizers were there to train every single volunteer on how to have conversations. We didn't have a script, which I think worked out really well actually, because I think especially in such a primary where A, we had a candidate who we didn't know what messages would resonate, and B, we had a primary where the candidates were so similar in a lot of ways that it took us a lot, you know, it became really interesting to figure out what people really were excited to hear about, especially for a, you know, gay Midwest mayor veteran. and so I think the way that we thought about every single organizer was that an organizer would get so nitty-gritty with every volunteer. And so, you know, if I was my mom's organizer, I would be saying like, did you talk to your friend today? How did that conversation go? What is your relationship like with her? Do you usually talk about politics? Do you think that she's interested in Pete? Do you have a history of talking about politics with her in the past? Do you know if she's even a voter? What do you think makes her excited? Like that would be how nitty gritty organizers would get when they were talking to people. And so instead of training, you know, I think in campaigns, we have a tendency sometimes to think of a training team as the team that makes, you know, decks, the team that makes slideshows for organizers, you know, every 3 weeks when they, or 3 months when they do like an all staff. But what we did really was we pushed the training all the way down so that organizers were training people how to have each conversation based on that person's relationship. And then eventually those volunteers were training their friends and their own family how to have conversations with their networks. And so it was very decentralized, but also training became a part of literally everything that we did. We had this incredible woman who was running our training and leadership development program. We also bucketed in leadership development so that we were training on everything constantly. And I think that made a huge difference. I also think it made a huge difference because especially in Iowa, I think you work with a lot of activists that have done the work cycle after cycle, and we had to break some habits. And so, you know, we had people that were like, I'm ready to knock doors. And we were like, actually start with the dinner table. And they were like, whoa, what? And so I think that ended up being really helpful too.
Yeah.
In terms of data, you're totally right. Data is tough. The Democratic Party, if we want to keep doing programs that I think are smart, needs to come a long way on data. We should definitely have a real conversation with Van. So the way to get into the mechanics of how we did it a little bit, we, again, as the two things that we cared about for a while were relational volunteers and relational conversations. And so for relational volunteers, we just marked them in Van with an activist code. I, again, think that the more we go down this, we don't need to call them relational volunteers. I think it was important for us at the time because we were trying to run a different kind of program, but they are just volunteers. And we would just mark them with an activist code, and we held organizers accountable to how many they had. And every state had a slightly different definition for what that meant, which was so fun for me to look at all these different reports with different definitions. But essentially, we also paid attention to if people hadn't had conversations in a while, they would drop off. So they would no longer be a relational volunteer, and organizers it would be responsible for getting those folks back. So that was more of like a health metric. The second thing was conversations. Conversations was difficult. So we built an external report. I think that essentially it was just a way for people to say that they had ever had a conversation. I think what we learned, we initially had it so that volunteers would self-report, so they would say that they had a conversation. That did not work well. You should probably not have you should not be incumbent on your volunteers to do their reporting for you. And so later we made it so that organizers could report when their volunteers had conversations. I think some people don't feel super comfortable with this because, you know, it puts a lot of control in organizers' hands. I actually think it worked way better, and pushing control down was really good. Our organizers, you know, were not especially like, well, they are all very special, but they were not like unique in the world of politics. But I think giving them more control over their own reporting, and specifically over reporting things that were genuinely election winning, like how many conversations we were having on the field every single day, ended up being really good. And they felt a lot of ownership over that. And I think that that was something that I think was really critical to our program, was pushing that control downwards. I also will say that, you know, there was a poll that came out in, it was late October, sometime in October, that had us, that showed us 10 points ahead in Iowa, which was a surprise for everyone, us included. And I think it's important to note that that was also, you know, the couple weeks that that poll was in the field was also the weeks when we had by far the most number of conversations, you know, triple, quadruple the number of conversations we had been having. And so I think it's important to note that, you know, I don't know that that necessarily like would have led to that many votes, because when, you know, polling doesn't equal people actually showing up to caucus for 3 hours on a cold Monday night. But I do think that it was important that, you know, it was a better representation that we weren't just making a ton of phone calls and knocking a ton of doors and you know, having a 3-5% contact rate, but instead we were having physically that many conversations and could count on those conversations actually being effective because they were supposedly between people who trusted each other.
Wow, that's incredible. And I love so much of that. I come from a union organizing background, and the idea of like how you have sort of more intense conversations and how you map power is another exercise that, you know, it's essentially a lot of this is of like, how do you map the relationship out from the activists who come to your campaign?
Totally. And it should be so noted here that we did not invent relational organizing. We stole it from unions. We stole it from communities of color who have organized in this way for a long time. We just tried to apply it to an electoral campaign. But relational organizing is a better version of organizing. You know, if you were trying to do, if you were trying to win a local race right now, like we are as campaign staff, you know, think, okay, we got to start by getting van and then we've got to, you know, cut our own universes. But if you wanted to get 50 votes right now, you would text 50 of your friends. You wouldn't text 50 unknown numbers in your zip code hoping that they worked. Like, union organizing is a fundamental background of relational.
Yeah. No, I think it's so important, and it makes me so happy to see these crossovers and to see it with such success, as your program showed. Actually, what you just said sort of bleeds beautifully into my next question, which is, what advice would you give to a campaign that wants to incorporate relational organizing tactics? And I'm going to make this like a two-parter. What would you say to someone who wants to incorporate these this year, like this cycle? Yep. And maybe then let's also give some advice to those folks who are going to be running campaigns for the next, you know, decade or so.
Totally. It's a good clarifier. So I think for specifically for this cycle, we know that the reason why we knock doors is because we believe that people, you know, having a face-to-face conversation is probably the most effective way to talk, but it's because it simulates closeness. But we don't need to knock doors if you are close with people in your life who are voters. I could call my mom right now, and even though I can't fly across the country and knock on her door, if I call her, I'm guessing that, and tell her to vote and make sure she, you know, sends in her ballot in Colorado, that is somebody that an organizer doesn't need to talk to. And so I think this cycle, you know, as much as we all miss knocking doors, we also need to remember that asking people to talk to their own networks is if not more effective, like, you know, also an opportunity, right? And we should be making that ask constantly and at every single level, you know? And I think some of the pushback is like, oh, well, I don't know if people are in my district. That's okay. We need everybody to vote Democrat this fall. Like, whether it's a big election, a small election, the more you can do to also make sure that that ask is included constantly, the better you'll be. And so, you know, I think some iterations of relational have been like, bring your friends and family to a you know, an office opening or whatever. But this cycle, it should literally be, if you're having a virtual phone bank, at the beginning of the phone bank, spend 5 minutes, have people write down a list of people that they know, have them think about whether that person is probably a Democrat, probably a Republican, and if you can talk about politics with them. And then, you know, in the next phone bank, ask for an update, ask for a success story, ask for something, but keep it a part of what you're doing. And so it doesn't have to be a central component of your program, especially with less than 60 days to go. You know, it can be something that you tack on, but make sure that you're doing it consistently. Make sure you are explaining why it's effective, and make sure that you are, you know, holding people accountable, and it doesn't have to be in a specific, like, I know every single person you said you knew way, but it's a way where you're consistently emphasizing that it's important. The other day, my friend's mom called her and was like, I really want to get involved more. She was super hype about Kamala's speech at the convention. And she really wanted to get involved. And she was saying, like, what do I do? She's never made phone calls in her life. And so I connected her with the organizer. But I also said, who in your life can you talk to? And she called me a couple days later and was like, all right, I talked to this person and I got this person on board and this person is excited. And I didn't know this person was a Democrat. And, you know, it's not totally natural for people to do. And it's not intuitive that is the most effective thing you can do. But it is the most effective thing you can do. For future campaigns, I think the best thing you can do is start with relational. I don't think that relational can replace direct voter contact, but I do think that it is a better way to start a campaign. And so from the very beginning, you know, the first thing you can do, especially if it's early and nobody's really excited about the election yet, it might not make sense to want to start knocking doors right away when people are like, oh my God, give me 8 more months. But instead, by just starting with people talking to their friends and family, start with that, figure out how many people you can reach, figure out what that reach looks like, and then that'll give you a smarter universe and a smaller universe to be able to reach through door knocking, through phone calls, through texting. But at least at that point, you've reached who you can reach otherwise. I think it's also important to note here that one thing that makes me crazy, and I'm probably the biggest offender of this, is we, you know, every single cycle campaigns pick up and leave, and we leave no infrastructure behind. We leave a bunch of people, you know, we think we do, because we think we, you know, the next time we need somebody to go knock doors, we got all these people who know how, or, you know, in a couple of years, we'll come back and we'll ask them to make calls again. But we need to start training people how to organize, not just what to do when we hand them a clipboard or hand them a phone sheet. And I have run texting programs, which is the least infrastructure you can leave. You spam a bunch of people and then, you know, you take the tool with you when you go. But I think that's one of the most important things for me about relational organizing, and why I don't want this to be synonymous with a tool, is because we need to train people how to talk about politics with their own networks. As easy as those conversations are, you know, me calling my dad who votes every single year and just reminding him, and as hard as those conversations are, me talking to my friend's dad who's a Republican and who's a huge Trump supporter, and me, you know, I still have a relationship with him, and I will be the best voice that he can listen to. And it's hard and it's awful, but A, that's the best way for us to leave long-term infrastructure in a place, but B, it's also the best way for us to actually start bringing our country back together and doing it long-term and having these conversations again. I mean, we look at why Hillary lost, and Democrats were nervous to even say that they supported Hillary Clinton, right? We all went into that secret Pantsuit Nation Facebook group, and we you know, surrounded ourselves with an echo chamber and we stopped talking. And I think the more that we start to have those conversations again about values more than about candidates, the more we'll all, and having those conversations long-term, the better off I think we're all going to be.
I love so much of what you just said. Thank you so much. I think that, you know, your everything that you've said and drawn from the fact that, like, relational organizing sometimes is just good organizing, period, yeah, and is a way to build these long-term structures and infrastructure that we so often talk about and lament our inability to do on campaigns. And then also, you know, how relational can be used for persuasion, for capacity building. You know, we so often talk about relational for turnout of, hey, you know, remind your friend, remind your family to vote. But we can also begin programs early that really invest in the relationship so that we are, as you have done, recruiting volunteers from within, you know, our relational volunteers, as you named it, and then also having those tougher conversations sometimes with folks who might not agree with us and might not hold the same opinions. But, you know, if we keep at it and start early, there's a good strength there and good possibility of what we could accomplish.
Totally. And I think especially for, you know, for a primary, it's great because we all know Democrats in our lives mostly. But for a general election, I would argue relational is probably absolutely the best for, specifically for building, for recruiting volunteers, for bringing people into the organization. We are all tending to surround ourselves with like-minded people. I know that we are all thinking of volunteers right now who just know other volunteers and Democratic activists. And those are the people who probably don't have a ton of GOTV targets in their life and who don't need to necessarily remind their networks to vote. They're probably all voting. But it is great for capacity building and for bringing new people into the organization. We really found that.
I love it. Well, Greta, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today. We really, really, really appreciate it. I feel like I could continue this conversation for another hour easily. And just thank you so much. And I'm excited to see where this conversation goes.
I am too. I'm really excited for us to keep having this conversation. I feel like, you know, on Pete, more than anything, we learned that there is so much cool stuff for us to learn.
Absolutely. And then we have our second conversation of today. So Robert Reynolds is a behavioral scientist whose passion for designing research-based programs to spark non-activists to nudge their friends to vote. Robert Reynolds is the founder of VoteTripling.org, an organization that helps to spread this tactic of vote tripling, which is a turnout tactic to increase voter participation. Robert was previously at an organization called Ideas 42, where he designed behavioral innovation and ran RCTs. Robert is a former Obama White House staffer and campaign volunteer. And so excited to hear this conversation about how he has brought kind of a behavioral science and research background to this idea of how can we turn out more friends and family members to vote. Robert, welcome to the Arena Boiler Room podcast. I'm super curious to just start off with a heavy hitter question of what exactly is vote tripling? What is it as like an organizing concept and tactic, and why is it so powerful?
Yeah, first off, thanks for having me. To answer your question in one sentence, vote tripling is a friend-to-friend voter turnout technique. It's not a technology product. It's just an organizing tactic, and it's rooted in two things: getting people to pledge to hold three friends accountable to vote, and then sending them reminders to make sure they take action on election day. It's based on a bunch of behavioral science research that I can share with you later on, and it's also not built for people like you and me, who I would call activists. This is a voter turnout technique custom designed for non-activists. And I have the contrarian belief that non-activists can boost a whole hell of a lot more friend-to-friend votes on election day than activists like you and I can.
Awesome. I'm so excited to dig into that. But also just want to ask then on the flip side, because we have vote tripling as a tactic, and then we also have votetripling.org as an organization that you are the executive director of. And so we're just hoping you could tell us a little bit more about what is votetripling.org.
Yeah, votetripling.org is a research and training organization. We are structured as a political action committee. And so we do research on friend-to-friend voter turnout techniques. And then for the things that we find to be effective, we train democratic political campaigns and progressive social justice organizations to use the things we found to be effective. And so that is what our organization does. We are made up of professional researchers and campaign professionals.
Well, super grateful for the work that you all do to help train folks on this particular tactic. I would love to dig into a little bit more about why this is so powerful. You mentioned activists versus non-activists and the ability to activate those non-activists. So I want to just recognize that you all, like, vote tripling was a pretty early evangelist of what we call relational organizing, friend-to-friend outreach. So I was hoping we could dig into a little bit on the research, what you mentioned is the behavioral science research that went into developing vote tripling as a tactic.
So I guess I would start by saying we did not invent friend-to-friend voter turnout or relational organizing. As best I understand, friend-to-friend voter turnout techniques were a core part of the strategy Abraham Lincoln used when he was running campaigns and when he himself ran for office 180 years ago. And our organization is definitely not 180 years old. So we did not invent this. Our story is, I can get into how this happened by like telling a short story. But so I studied behavioral science in graduate school and was working as a behavioral scientist at a research organization at the time of the 2016 election. And after that election, really just wanted to do whatever I could to play my part in helping us defeat Trump in these 4 years and build a more progressive country. And so like the one tool I have or one area of expertise I have is research. And so I started studying like, what do we know from research that works? And what I quickly learned is like the most powerful way to get more people to vote is for them to be reminded by their friends. And so I learned this through studies. Other people learn this through common sense because it just makes sense. Like social influence works across all sorts of domains. But what seems striking to me in the wake of the 2016 election was that when I started talking to people who were deep in this space and they would talk about their friend-to-friend voter turnout programs, they would always start by saying, we get our volunteers to do X. And it was like these programs were restricted to things that volunteers would do. And that just, to me, seemed incomplete. Like, I think volunteers are important. I'm an activist. I, like, especially after the 2016 election, was very, very involved. But I think when it comes to friend-to-friend voter turnout, activists are uniquely unpowerful. And those who are most disengaged are uniquely extremely powerful. So I think activists are obviously important for a million things when it comes to campaigns. But I think when it comes to friend-to-friend voter turnout, non-activists have far more power. And I think that for three reasons. First is because non-activists are the majority. 97% of people who vote for Joe Biden this year will have done zero volunteering for his campaign. And so I'll rewind. What we mean when we say non-activists is something very specific. People who vote but don't volunteer for campaigns or related causes. And my little brother is one of these people. Like he will definitely vote in 2020, but he is not going to go do any form of formal volunteering. And so he's like 97% of people who will vote for Joe Biden. So that's the first reason non-activists are powerful, is they are the majority. Second is because of their networks. Because birds of a feather flock together, non-activists like my little brother are just much more closely connected to irregular voters than activists like you and I. Mm-hmm. And lastly, because of their influence, there's behavioral science research that says activists like me come off as the boy who cried wolf, because each and every election we're barking about how it's the most important race in the generation. Where when a non-activist like Nikki is talking about the importance of voting, it sounds totally different. It's striking. And it's like, wow, if Nikki is telling people to go vote, like this time really must be different. Everyone must be getting involved. And so in the early days after the 2016 election, like I became very kind of obsessed with this idea of how do we get non-activists to mobilize their friends? Like this is going to be very hard because by definition, like they are disengaged. But behavioral science is really good at creating like elegant, lightweight solutions to things like to these sorts of problems. So I could talk more about the research, but I want to pause there. And that's kind of the problem as we defined it, which is that the progressive community has lots of solutions in place to get people like you and I to remind 100 friends to vote, or to like download some app and learn like, oh, our dentist is like a diehard Democrat, but who doesn't vote. And like, that is one suite of solutions that we need. But we also need a different set of solutions for non-activists.
All right. I think that's all. Like, it's so fascinating. And thank you for sharing sort of the origin story of both, you know, your engagement within the electoral space and bringing sort of behavioral science tools to this space. I don't know. I feel like you and I have probably seen this graph 1,000 times, and I'm sure a lot of folks on campaigns have seen this, which is the Analyst Institute sort of measurement of the effectiveness of different voter turnout modes, as they call it. And you have sort of mail on there, you have, you know, door to door, you have phone calls, you have cold text messaging, you have warm text messaging, and then you have this like outlier, which is relational organizing, which is shown to be so much more effective than so many of these other tactics. want to do a side note of like, these tactics are layered, right? So, you know, we're not just sending someone a text message. We are also sending them a mail piece or a television ad or whatever it is. But what's really outstanding is how effective relational organizing looks compared to a lot of these. You obviously, through your research and your work in behavioral science, knew some of that, what you said, of sort of the power of friend-to-friend outreach. But actually would love to dive a little bit more into how that brought about vote tripling as a tactic, and specifically want to think about what you just said as far as how do we activate non-activists? Because again, I think so many of us, especially volunteers, are used to, okay, I'm going to text 5 of my friends. But how do we reach the non-activists? Like, how does that actually work?
Yeah, I'll talk about how we reach non-activists in a second, but I would like to say something on like the graph you talked about, which is like people have known for a long time that like relational tactics are more powerful, but the problem as I understood it was they were like hard to scale. So it's like, it's if you like Julia were running for Congress in 2016 and you're like, wow, I can run a relational program. It's going to be 10 times more effective than other things, but I can only get 10 human beings in my district to remind their friends. Even if that's 10 times more effective, that's less effective in some than your ability to send mail to like 100,000 people. And so it's been known that these techniques are effective at an individual level, but like, how do you scale them? And so that's what we have worked on solving. And so we have, in general, 3 techniques. Actually, I'm just going to talk about 2 to save us time. One is an SMS program that we've designed and refined, where we found that if you can ask people to take a relational ask over a cold text message outreach, and you collect information from them, and then you send them these personalized reminders before election day. So I guess more specifically, we can text someone like my little brother, Nikki, and ask him like, hey, we're asking all of our supporters, can we count on you to get 3 friends to vote? Like a subset of Nikki's will say yes to that. And then you can follow up with one thing from our research we find is really, really important is to ask them to share the names of their friends. And so Nikki will say, like if my brother were to sign up for this, he would say Apple, Jack, Mia, and Tony, which are his like 3 closest friends. And then you have this like really, really useful information. Instead of on election day, then sending Nikki a reminder that says, hey, go vote, or get your friends to vote, or get 3 friends to vote. You're saying something really, really specific, which is like, get Applejack, Mia, and Tony. And that's like, that like clicks in your mind in a totally different way, where it's like an immediate next step of who to reach out to, rather than just like kind of abstractly like agreeing to this, like, I don't know, opaque idea of reminding friends in general. And so we get, through a text message program, people to make specific plans around which friends they'll mobilize and then send reminders. So that's one version. And a second version is something we call polling place vote tripling, where organizations who have poll greeters out at the polling places, instead of having them do just the things that poll greeters traditionally do, you ask voters as they're exiting to stop and right then and there and remind 3 friends to vote. And what we find is that this program appears to work 10 times better than election day canvassing. Wow. And the reason is very simple, which is that if I go knock on doors on election day, I'll get about 4 voter contacts per hour. Maybe it's more, maybe it's less, but like roughly in that vicinity. And that will be activist to stranger outreach. If I go stand at a polling place on election day in a heavily Democratic precinct, I will get dozens of people to stop and say they will remind their friends to vote. And they will do that right in front of me. And they will remind on average like 3 or 3.1 friends. And so that will lead to many dozens of voter contacts per hour. And they aren't stranger to, or they aren't activist to stranger contacts. They are friend to friend. And so those are the, we've designed a variety of things. Some of the things don't work during COVID, but the 2 things that do work are this text message program and this polling place vote tripling program.
That's fascinating. I remember the first time I heard about polling place tripling, it just blew my mind because it seems like such a sort of logical way to reach a lot of people where they are. Like we say this over and over again in organizing, meet people where they are.
Yeah.
On election day, people are at the polls.
So yeah.
Let's go meet them there. And then the ability then to expand that outreach to, you know, if you are going to vote at the polls and I ask you to remind at least three friends, maybe more, for them to go and vote as well.
I think if we care about getting non-activists to remind their friends to vote, like, I think polling place vote tripling is just like the fucking, it is like the best way to do that. Because like, if you're a non-activist, like my little brother, Nikki, you do not spend your life marching around thinking about elections, like every 5 minutes, like I do and like you do, Julia. But like, if you're Nikki and you're marching outside of a polling place after election day, you are glowing. You're in this state that behavioral scientists call warm glow, where like you are wearing your I voted sticker, you identify as a voter, and you are just like damn proud of what you just did. And it's this like fleeting moment that happens once every 4 years where we can get someone to take on, we can move them up the ladder of engagement. And if you are a non-activist, I think the first rung or the most important rung on the ladder of engagement should be to mobilize your friends, because you can go spend hours reaching out to strangers, but you already have non-voters in your immediate social network who like, you know how to contact and they trust you. And that should be our first ask of you. And so it's just this really special moment that we can
capitalize on.
Yeah. That's the word I was thinking of.
Yeah. I love that there's a phrase for that, a warm glow. That's just, that's amazing. So we've talked about like the power of vote tripling and the power of how votetripling.org has thought about relational organizing as applies to engaging non-activists. And then you all, of course, work closely with campaigns and organizations in order to help them implement these practices in their own voter contact universes.
Yeah.
And so I'm just curious about like what advice you would give to a campaign that wants to adopt vote tripling as a tactic.
Yeah. Reach out to us, contact@votetripling.org. We strive to create things that are so simple and so elegant that like training is not needed. Like you, Julia, are like an expert in training. You don't need to hear anything more from us on polling place vote tripling. You can go do it without us. But what we see often is like campaign staff are so overworked and just have so many, many, many things going on that when they try to adopt these techniques without our support, they usually only get 25% of the pledge rate. And like these programs are like similar to a commit to vote pledge program in that like the impact you will get is proportional to how many pledges you get. People make simple errors. We see like using the wrong scripts, and like we've tested these thoroughly and like have specific recommendations because other things we've seen don't work, or like they won't ask for the friends' names in the right way, or they'll like botch the data collection. And so if someone wants to use these techniques, please reach out to us, because we will provide you with personalized trainings on how to run these programs well. And we will do that if you are a Democratic campaign in a battleground state, all for free. And you can take as much of our training as you want, or as little. But we have supported over 100 groups over the last few years. And so we've seen how to do this right, but we've also seen how to do this wrong enough times that we can like tell a group like, hey, like actually I would recommend to not do that, because like this group in Pittsburgh just did that last week and it like totally failed miserably. So like, I don't know, be warned. So my advice is reach out to us, contact@votetripling.org, and we will support you at no cost.
That's awesome. Thank you, Robert. I think that, you know, what you just said as well kind of points to one of the challenges overall on campaigns of innovating, of making changes. I feel like campaigns, you know, since 2008, 2012 with Barack Obama, sort of adopted a new model of organizing, really embraced organizing, direct voter contact, door-to-door, person-to-person. And, you know, then also a lot of data has been built into that of how effective these things are in measuring the effectiveness. And sometimes I think because of that, it can be really hard for campaigns to adopt something new or to try something new because the stakes feel so high.
Yeah.
And so I think it, you know, it makes a lot of sense to me that there's an organization such as yours that is dedicated to helping campaigns adopt this new tactic, because
yeah.
otherwise it can seem like the barriers are insurmountable to actually implementing a program like this.
Yeah. I mean, everyone on campaigns is doing at least two people's jobs. And so it's
oh,
hard
yeah.
to like push out new things. So yeah, we're not the only group that it's, I don't know, providing training to campaigns, but we are very laser focused or narrowly focused, however you want to frame it, on training around solving this one problem or addressing this one problem of how do we get non-activists to mobilize their friends to vote. Can I share one other thought on something you said?
Please.
Around organizing. One thing we want to be very careful about is we don't refer to our stuff as relational organizing because we don't want to like appropriate that terminology of what we do is friend-to-friend voter turnout. This is a tactic that the impact of it is boosting voter turnout. It does not have the other benefits of like organizing generally. So like we don't want
sure.
to like many of the things I think campaigns do that they refer to as relational organizing have lots of benefits beyond just boosting voter turnout. But that's our thing is just that. And so we try not to like I don't know, claim it does anything beyond just boosting turnout.
Yeah. I really appreciate that. And I think it's a really, really good point because, you know, there is a difference between organizing and what we think of organizing as far as, you know, I think at the end of the day, organizing is about building power for a sustainable
yeah.
future. And, you know, I think making the distinction of, yes, this is a powerful tactic that uses relational aspects, but at the end of the day, its purpose is towards boosting turnout, not necessarily,
yeah.
you know, and that turnout hopefully builds that longevity and that power for Democrats. However, it's not sort of the same tactic as organizing.
Yeah, but it's not transactional in the way that many voter turnout tactics can be, in that like we find people are delighted to be asked to remind their friends to vote. Like it is a flattering thing to hear a campaign volunteer tell like an everyday American like, no matter how hard I try, you are going to be way better at getting your friends to vote than some stranger like me volunteering for a campaign. So it is, the only effect is turnout, but it's we find that like this technique delights voters rather than being off-putting in the way that some transactional tactics can be.
That's amazing. Thank you so, so much, Robert. This has been a fascinating conversation. I so appreciate hearing about VoteTripling's work, about the research that goes into it and behind it. I think that so often, you know, on campaigns, we're told to sort of accept something and maybe look at the Analyst Institute when we want an answer or justification for it. And I love hearing about, you know, all of the work that you all have done that's based in research and developing from there. So thank you so much for sharing all of this and really appreciate the lens towards activating non-activists. What you said, I think that our society will be a better place if we get more people involved in the system. It's the antidote to voter suppression, right?
Yeah.
It's the antidote to suppress voter turnout is just how do we empower more people to see their place in this political process.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk to you sometime soon.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Robert.
Thank you.